Trib Live Radio presents the Sports Reporters.
By virtue of being on this battlefield, there is no return. People will die. Some will be disfigured.
Always professional.
And as usual, no touching of the hair and face.
Fighting it out on all the biggest topics of the week.
There's not going to be any fight without Scott Riles and the incredibly polite Canadian news team.
Give me a break. They can't have news. Nothing happens in Canada.
We're going to gouge your eyes out and kick your head in.
Sorry. I like your ginger ale.
It's time to start the brawl.
Who are you wearing today? Oh, look, it's your own blood.
The Sports Reporters on Trib Live Radio.
A Friday staple of Trib Live Radio, Sports Reporters time here at TribLive.com. Ken Laird, Guy Junker, Josh Taylor, special in-studio guests, Mike Culligan from CulliganHockey.com, and, of course, formerly of the Hockey Writers, Penn's blog, and you got your own site also with the Forbes Money thing going on still, right, Mike? How many sites are you working for these days?
6 to 10 on average here, only on weekdays.
That's beautiful. Well, we got a hell of a week of Penguins hockey to digest here, so great week to have you in studio. More of the same last night, I suppose, although, boy, they did everything but score in the third period last night, trying to empty the cabinet for a tying goal in Dallas. But four games this week, two goals. Your diagnosis is what?
Not panic time yet. Okay. I don't think I'm seeing significant issues that I haven't seen all season. So that said, I don't think this is a Stanley Cup favorite. I don't think it's an Eastern Conference favorite. I think when I look at the path that they potentially have in front of them, the New York Rangers, Washington Capitals, I don't think they beat either of those teams. But the way the playoffs are, they may never see both of those teams, and we'll see what this team is able to do. And I think when you look at the East in general, it's wide open. And the way the Penguins are playing now, a little more focus on the defensive end of the ice. And I think when you have guys like Evgeny Malkin, Patrick Hornquist out of the lineup, we're seeing this a pretty average team offensively. Sidney Crosby and then a bunch of second and third rate guys that aren't producing the offense to really score in a lot of these games.
Or is this just every game in the league is 2-1 now, and this is actually par for the course?
It's unbelievable how the game has changed this year, and maybe this is going on for a couple years now. Maybe this is the way the league is taking concussions and the speed of the game down to a more manageable level, is allowing a lot more of the holding, the hooking, grabbing. I mean, it's really noticeable at this point, to the point you'd think it's almost conscious that they're calling the game this way. Unfortunately, that doesn't play into the style of the Penguins, a high-speed, smaller team that really cannot get into a physical grinding type of game and come away with a lot of victories.
But there are other teams like them, no? I mean, Ottawa scores 6 against Boston yesterday. Are they not similar in terms of makeup? The Islanders, who else would you put in their category of a team that's stylistically?
Tampa Bay would
they
be one.
There you go.
When you look at Tampa Bay up front, they've got a second line that is, I'd be shocked if anyone's over 5'10 on that line, but it's one of the best in the league because they have speed and they have skill. The Penguins have a lot of speed. I don't know that they necessarily have the skill, and especially when you get down to that third and fourth line. Bo Bennett, Brandon Sutter, they've got flashes. We've seen inconsistent play from both of them,
yeah,
but we haven't seen that consistent offensive production from kind of the secondary scoring perspective.
Which is, as Josh, everything Jim Rutherford tried to do, secondary scoring. That was the mantra of the offseason, and even at the trade deadline. And, you know, the frustration has bubbled over this week with our listeners. Jag off of the week goes to the NHL officials, but the Penguins organization was close second, you know, so not going to be helped by last night's performance.
No, and Rob Rossi's been talking about it all week. You know, this team has this really inability to get past some of the things that get in their way. They have a hard time overcoming adversity, and that's something they haven't really been able to handle. A lot of the adversity they face has nothing to do with the score on the scoreboard, and that's hard because when you're almost trying to play two different games, and you can't play two different games. You're trying to play a game where you're trying to actually outscore the other team, and then you're trying to almost outthink yourselves while trying to still overcome what's going on around you with not having calls called. And that's something that really messes up everything because it throws everything off. And you're seeing that result, I think, on the score sheet. It's not necessarily because it's taking them out of their game. They're not able to play their game because they're still playing their game. They're still getting shots on net, and Jesse Marshall spelled that out for us yesterday. They're still actually trying to gain possession in the neutral zone. They're still getting shots on net. Those shooting percentages are down, so they're still doing what they do from that aspect. But when you're trying to play more than one game, more often than not, you're probably going to lose both.
Well, mental part of the game, Mike. I mean, Chris Letang was, again, last night, just totally lost it. I mean, I don't know if he's the face of their frustration. Oh, sorry, guy. We're going to put your mic.
Oh, sorry. Right when he gets nominated for, you know, for perseverance and sportsmanship. He's shown so little sportsmanship the last two games that they should take that nomination away immediately.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a way, he's passionate. You want that. You want Steve Downey to care. You know, these guys are trying to change their fortunes. But the officiating and the perceived vendetta against them, Mike, do you...
Oh, I think
you believe it.
Last night, if you watched that game and what happened to Chris Letang, it was obvious. There was not only the situations where he was getting involved personally, but then penalties that were being taken against him being totally overlooked. And I think that's the problem. When you have that reputation, not only does one referee start to look at you differently, but it's a group there. You know, that's a family mentality amongst referees. And we saw that, you know, go back 20 years ago with Kerry Frazier and Paul Stewart and referees that used to make themselves a big part of the story of the game, and they would take it out on Mario Lemieux and the times that he reacted many times in the same way. I think we're seeing that against Chris Letang right now, and that's a problem, as you mentioned, when they get distracted by that element and that becomes what they're focused on, all of the other things kind of go out of the wayside, and that starts with the head coach. I mean, the head coach has to get through to this group. I don't know if he has that credibility or that reputation right now, but that's going to be a key factor in the playoffs.
Yeah, you could see Johnston come over and try to almost personally talk to Letang, but Josh, I don't know that he's listening or anything. I mean, at this point, tough too when you're in the heat of the battle. I mean, no matter who is back there behind the bench, Chris Letang's going to go off when he's pushed, but does Johnston have the hammer quotient to be able to come down and change things even between games later in the week, etc.?
I don't know if it matters because he's not the only one talking. You would hear Bill Guerin on Sportsnet talking about how he felt about it, how they've identified it as a problem, like he said, how they need to fix it. And it seems like they're not listening. Rick Tockett's spoken up about it, and it seems like they're not listening. So if they're not listening to Rick Tockett and Bill Guerin, I don't know if it matters if Mike Johnston says it. I don't know if it matters if anybody says it at this point, unless Mary Lemieux comes down the locker room and pulls them all together and says, look, maybe you should text them all like you did the night before game 7 and 0-9 for the point to get across. But for right now, for as many people that are respected guys, not only in that room, but respected around the league, they're telling them, look, you got to snap out of it and go play and let this stuff go and stop whining and ignore all this crap. They're still not listening.
Well, it's interesting, Garrett. I mean, he's the last connection piece to the cup here. How did it work out that year, Mike? I mean, he must have seen that happening.
Guerin, I think he has this rosy reputation right now. It wasn't that way.
Yeah, that's true.
In that time, you know, he came in and he was face to face, head to head with Sidney Crosby, and he really made some waves in a way that if they didn't win the Stanley Cup that year, I think we'd have a very different perspective on Bill Guerin and his arrival and what he was able to do to that team. Now, it worked out, so when you come in and you shake things up a little bit, that's a great sign, but I think we've seen that perspective change. And I think the other problem is Steve Downey. You mentioned him, and how do you rely on that guy in the playoffs at this point? When you watch him, he doesn't have control over himself. And no matter what you tell him to do, when that energy level takes it up a notch or two, those guys lose total control. And I don't know how you can put him on the ice in a critical playoff situation.
Well, James Neal was that way as well. I mean, but they got rid of him, and I feel like that was part of the equation. This year, I feel like this team has handled it better until this week. Like this is the week they fell off the cliff, and now they've been pushed. They've lost four in a row, so... But this is, as you say, Mike, what they're going to face in the postseason, right? I mean, you're going to face adversity. You're going to have some tough stretches. So every evidence pointing to they're going to be unglued again.
Yeah. Teams know that. When they scout the Penguins, that's the pregame meeting. And I've played on teams that have been like that where the coach says, we've got three guys here that if you get them wound up a little bit, they're going to take penalties. They're going to get off their game. Go after them and hit them as hard as you can every chance you get. And I think that we're seeing that happen. We're going to see that in the playoffs. We've seen the Penguins lose control in the past. It's a lot of the same guys. Despite, you know, all of these minor changes, this is still the same core that has melted down in the past. And we've seen that over the last few weeks here as the style and the intensity of the games has really picked up a notch.
Well, very interesting to see the standings here this morning. And they do have a game in hand on the Capitals, but tied with 88 points right now, the Caps for the wild card spot.
Ottawa's two behind Boston, and it is not beyond belief that the Penguins could not make the playoffs if they don't snap out of it soon. I mean, it would take an incredible collapse, but it's not mathematically out of the question. Not even close.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the same thing. I mean, That's a 7-point edge. The Senators would have to leap over two teams here. So the Penguins would have to fade below the Bruins and the Sens. Mike, to miss the postseason, and Josh. But if you lose four in a row, you start to question everything, question the foundation. They do have still a pretty easy schedule, but they played the Devils this week. You expect points in that game. Even a Dallas team that's out of the postseason. Could they possibly slide so far in March that we're questioning postseason appearances at all?
And let's go back a week. They had a hard time with Edmonton with a 4-0 lead at home and let them come back and tie the game.
Yeah.
It just seems like this team does not know how to take being pushed. And they can get out ahead of people, but they can't finish them off. And if they get pushed at the beginning, they can't catch up. And they can't overtake it. I don't think they won a game yet this season when they're trailing going into the third period. And it's March. That's absolutely hard to believe. 4.5 months into the season and you can't come back and win a game in the third period. Mm-hmm. That's a really big black mark against this team. That not only does it help the fact that our previous discussion we were talking about with this team dealing with the referees, you can't have it both ways. You can't complain about every call you get and you're the most penalized team in the league. It seems really backwards. It's almost like they don't know necessarily which direction they're walking in, or it's one step forward, two steps back for this team, because there's so many things that are keeping them from probably playing the way that they should, that they can't get out of the blocks and play the way they should.
I think on the flip side, though, think of this Penguins team as we sat in the same moment in the season, and usually it's the Penguins are coasting. The Penguins are
right.
Well into first place. They hit the playoffs, and it's suddenly a different level of hockey, and they're not ready for it. So while they're looking out of sorts at this point, maybe this is the best thing for this group, is they start to get a little wound up and into that playoff mentality where you're really competing for not only a playoff spot, but for seeding, for home ice. I think that could be a good thing as we look forward to potentially shaking it up from the playoffs perspective.
As long as their confidence isn't totally just trashed, you know, and then you don't want to go completely the other direction. Saturday in Arizona, they have a home game next Tuesday with St. Louis, one of their few remaining playoff teams on the schedule coming here. Then at Carolina for a kind of a strange 2 weeks of mostly road trips, strange teams in different positions. You'll eventually get some Flyers, Islanders games in the last month of the year, which are going to bring out more of the passion. Mike Collin with us here on the Hockey Writers. On the Sports Reporters. He's from the Hockey. Was from the Hockey Writers. Too many sites to keep track of. Here with our Penguins talk on the Sports Reporters on Trib Live Radio. Do you see, Mike, with this team, the ability to, do they have the personnel to score dirty goals in the postseason? Are they built for defense? I mean, should we expect 2-1, 3-2 type of games? And is that fine with them as long as, you know, they're the ones that can net 2 or 3? When Gino and Hornquist come back, they are a different team, but they look like they are structured to be a defensive-minded squad.
I think that's at least the approach. I don't know that the roster is necessarily built that way yet, and maybe we give this team time to really restructure in the offseason and give Jim Rutherford, assuming he's still here, the opportunity to reshape that roster.
Yeah.
But I think they are going to focus on defense, but they've shown the ability to play those high-scoring games. You mentioned Edmonton last week, and that was a game that really opened up at one point, and I think that's going to be the focus. And this year, unfortunately, with that focus on defense, you aren't getting the offensive opportunities that they used to get. This is a team that scores a lot off the rush. You're not going to get odd man rush opportunities if you're focused on that defensive end of the ice. We saw under Dan Bylsma, they pushed the play. They had those stretch passes that were criticized so much, but that's what created those odd man opportunities. This isn't a team that's going to get in the offensive zone and grind you down and really create offense off of the cycle. They're going to score off odd man rushes, and they need to create those opportunities in order to get the scoring chances.
But they had trouble scoring under the old system. Right,
I think it became very predictable.
Yeah.
That was the problem, is it became so vanilla and predictable that after 3-4 years of teams scouting Dan Bylsma, they figured him out. Unfortunately, I think teams are starting to figure out Mike Johnson a little bit too. He simplified it, which is a good thing when you're just trying to get back to basics. But now I think we're going to see if Mike Johnson's truly an NHL coach. Can he really adapt, especially when you get in the playoffs where you've got a chess match between a lot of these head coaches as far as systems and plays go?
Yeah, and he's going to go up against some good coaches, right? I mean, the Rangers and the Islanders, say what you will about some new faces and new places there. Rangers, Melin Vigneault's got that team playing very well. I don't know, with the Babcock scenario hanging in the balance, if they would pull the trigger on that. But if it ends ugly, I have a hunch they're going to look long and hard at Mike Babcock.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. I think when I look at this team and Mike Johnston, I don't think has the job security if he loses in the first round, which I think is very possible. And in the NHL these days, you look at the St. Louis Blues. They've lost the first round the last 3 years. They potentially could play Chicago this year and lose in the first round again. They've been a great team. They've been a very, very good NHL team, and four first-round losses, that's probably going to mean the end of Ken Hitchcock there, which is hard to believe.
Wow.
But that's the way the NHL is, and so if the Penguins do lose in the first round, I totally agree. They set the standard, fair or not, last year when they came out and said the third round's not good enough.
Right.
They can't sit there and then watch a first-round loss and not have the temptation to go out and shake things up again. Unfortunately, that kills the identity and really what are the Penguins right now at this point? We knew what they were under Ray Shiro and Dan Bylsma, good, bad, indifferent. I don't really know what the Penguins are right now from an identity perspective.
And do you need to stick with something, Josh, for more than a year to let it have some identity? Maybe Mike Johnston would have a counterpunch in him next year. Maybe they could tweak the roster with some available cap space.
I'm sure Jim Rutherford would like more than a year to try to figure out what this team is. I think that might be part of the problem. I think with what he inherited, he's trying to probably shape it into an image that's different from what he inherited. But the thing is, no one really knows what the image is right now. Maybe it's because his work on that, from that aspect, isn't done yet.
Yeah.
And we, as much as people will criticize the moves that he's made this season, I know Rob Ross, he's been pretty vocal about it, especially on this air. But, you know, from what Jim Rutherford had to have in front of him and the assets he had on his side, and he didn't have many because a lot of draft picks had already been moved by Ray Shiro. So his assets are limited, and he's trying to improve something that he doesn't have a lot of power on his side to try to improve. So he's trying to make small changes, subtle moves, one thing at a time. And if nothing else, at least he tried to get this roster ready for a playoff run this season. And after this season, a couple of contracts are going to be up. Harv Martins will be up. Christian Ehrhoff will be up. Blake Comeau will be up. And he'll probably try to make some more moves to shape it more in that image of what he's looking for. But like you said, Mike, right now we don't know what that image is. We don't know what that identity is. And that's where the struggle lies. And we may not really know what Jim Rutherford's trying to do until maybe a year or two from now. So maybe it might take a year.
Well, Jim Rutherford's not a guy who's going to be around very long, and he even said so himself. I can't imagine Lemieux and Burkle hired Mike Johnston with the feeling of, we're patient, Mike, take your time here. I mean, being simple is one thing. I mean, to get your guys to buy in and to start to, you know, put the training wheels on and grow under the new look, but he's got to know he doesn't have 2 years. I mean, right? I mean, Johnston was hired knowing he's got to win now.
And you look at what the Penguins did at the trade deadline, going essentially not all in, but
yeah,
very aggressive with draft picks. And at this point now they're saying, this is our group. This is our window. We're going to go after it. And I think by sacrificing those picks over not only next year, but now digging into the 2016 draft, you're crunching that window a little bit. And you're saying, hey, over the next 2-3 years, we're going to really make a run for this, and I respect that if that's the way they're going to go, but I think you've got to realize that it's very tough to win year to year in the NHL and win a Stanley Cup in this era. With a small window to work with, that's going to be a challenge because you're not going to have – they already had no forward prospect depth. What happens now? How do they ever replace that or restock that group when you don't have any draft picks to work with? It's almost impossible.
Kasperi Kapanen better be like – megastar. You better be Connor McDavid Jr. He's the only guy they have in the system now.
He's Obi-Wan Kenobi. He's their only hope.
So. Well, they do have some money. I know, Mike, I know you focus a lot on the finances of hockey. You do a great job with it at Colleen Hockey. And the cap is going to go up a little bit. They have a little room, right? But this team, how major of a player can they be in the offseason and free agency?
I think the key is going to be this younger group of defense. We saw at the trade deadline, they didn't get rid of Derek Pouliot, Olli Maatta, Scott Harrington, Brian Dumoulin.
Yeah.
They realize that that is where their value is going forward, and if they can get those guys into the lineup contributing on very cheap rookie deals, that frees up the cash to then upgrade, you know, third lines a little bit more, find some areas where you can really start to spend a little bit of money, because if they bring in another Christian Ehrhoff, you don't have that flexibility. You lose that. And I think there's going to be teams that are facing some salary cap situations this year that will force players onto the market that otherwise wouldn't. You want to be in a position where you can take advantage of that, whether it's via trade, whether it's via free agency. We're going to see some teams that are really crunched as far as the cap goes because it's not rising as much as they thought over the next year here. I think we'll eventually see that cap take off, and we'll see it at the $80 million range, $85 million. But that's not going to be next year, so there's going to be teams with tough decisions to make.
That's interesting. And the Islanders kind of took advantage of that with Letty and Boychuk, right? Teams and cap problems at the beginning of last year. Defensemen, not forwards. But
and you think about the Islanders moving to Brooklyn next year, that's going to be a revenue boost. That's yeah. a guaranteed. This is going to be a pretty significant team now as far as the NHL goes, and they're going to be spending, and they're going to have that ability to really build a real roster. And when you look at that Penguins division over the next 5 years, and you've got the Capitals, the Rangers, who are in the middle of their window right now, the Islanders, there's some tough teams. If Columbus works their way in, it's going to be tough to make the playoffs out of that group.
And Crosby and Malkin getting a year older, so boy, it feels doom and gloom here today. They're certainly in the mix. Rutherford has said he believes this team has every bit of a chance to make a run as anybody else in the East. I mean, do you believe the East is wide open to a certain degree?
Absolutely. I think it's going to come down to matchups, and that's I would give the Penguins as much of a chance as anyone in the East. I wouldn't make them a favorite, but I think the problem is I do not think they match up with the Rangers or the Capitals. Those are two big teams, and when I've watched the Penguins consistently struggle this year, it's been teams with size on both ends of the ice where they can keep the Penguins from getting to the front of the net. Josh, you mentioned not having really much pressure in front of the net, not getting those dirty goals. That is what happens when you play some of these bigger teams, and those are two very well-coached teams. The Rangers' defense is unbelievable this year. Now with the addition of Keith Yandle, they've got six defensemen that I think could be top-pairing defensemen in this league, and I don't know that the Penguins have the firepower to really break that group down.
Sports reporters here on Trib Live Radio.
Well, I apologize for being a little bit out of the mix here. My wife's birthday was yesterday. She wants tickets for Earth, Wind, and Fire, which went on sale.
God.
They had to go on sale at 10 o'clock right now when we were starting the show. So I'm on there at 2 minutes to 10 thinking I'm going to be right in there. It took me 20 minutes to get them. So as I told Mike, I wouldn't walk across the street to see Earth, Wind, and Fire for free, but that's what she wants for her birthday. So anyway, here's something I don't think you guys have talked about. This is what's aggravating me about the recent trend here with the guys out. Why are they so desperate in the third period, and why don't they come out better at the beginning of the game? That's the only thing that bothers me. I understand, look, scoring's down everywhere. Even some of the guys on the Stars last night were saying this isn't just an issue with the Penguins. This is an issue league-wide right now. But the first periods are lethargic. How does Sidney Crosby go through a whole game without a shot on goal with everybody else out of the lineup? I mean, you know, he gets a great early chance on Tuesday night in All Alone. I mean, you know, the guy's not perfect, but you got to bury that. These other guys are out. Get that goal early against the Devils, and it's a completely different game. I don't like the way they're starting games. They're finishing them great. They've outshot the opposition in the third period the last three games about 100-22.
Yeah.
But where's all this fire at the beginning of the game?
That was a problem on the road trip. They scored one. Actually, they didn't score in the four-game Western trip. They did not have a first-period goal.
And if you recall back at the beginning of the year, at one point they had the most first period goals in the league. I'm talking about, you know, in early December. They piled up all their goals in the first period.
But
they scored the first goal almost every game.
Is that a early
system in the season?
Though? Isn't that like a Mike Johnston, we're going to come out and be careful, cautious. They're not taking chances in the first period.
What's funny, though, is I remember Johnston saying the opposite, where he said he at the beginning of the year had a quota. I forget what the number was, but I want 15 shots in the first 10 minutes. I can't remember at this point, but
right.
That was his MO, is come out, let's come out fast and hard. Hmm. We're not seeing that from the Penguins this year. And I think one other thing I thought about recently was getting offense from the defense. You know, that Chris Letang scored for the first time on the power play in quite a while, despite all the time that he gets. And there's really not much coming from the defense this year, despite how much Mike Johnston has those guys involved in the
offense.
That's
a good point. Erhoff's numbers in particular are surprisingly low.
I mean, you look in outside of Letang, I think the combined goal total of the defense is about 12 or 13 this year. There's really nothing coming from Paul Martin, nothing from Erhoff, guys that you think have some offensive ability.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem. I look at Sidney Crosby right now is so fixated on passing to the defense whenever he gets it down low in the zone. That's one thing if it's Letang. That's another thing if it's Rob Scuderi, who had zero goals and about five on his career. That is not the I'd rather the puck be on Sidney Crosby's stick, not Rob Scuderi taking a meaningless shot into the goal. So I think they've got to think about how do they generate offense once they're in that offensive zone.
Well, let's see where they go. Maybe they get Malkin Hornquist back next Tuesday, and that could spark everything else. And they've got a month to figure it out. I mean, basically, it's a huge month for the franchise and when were the crossroads and where they go from here.
Well, I agree with Mike about the matchups, and I also think as well as they played in the fall and as poorly as they've played recently, none of it matters if you finish strong. I mean, we've seen how teams finish. We've seen this in the NFL. Have a good final 2 weeks. Be playing the game the way you want to, your last six games, and I'll take my chances. You know, I think we've been duped in the past. You know, teams with over 100 points with, you know, with scoring champions on them and
definitely
number one power play in the league and, you know, great acquisitions at the trade deadline. Here we go. And it hasn't worked out. So the other thing is, though, I've been kind of, to me, the ace in the hole a little bit this year has been Fleury. I think it's his best regular season ever. And even he hasn't played that well the last couple of weeks. I would like to see him nice and tight down the stretch because I think they could ride him a little bit this year.
And that's what it comes down to for a lot of these playoff teams is you need that really good goaltending. We saw it out of Tuukka Rask in Boston in recent years. We've seen it with Jonathan Quick in L.A. When those guys are on, you can't beat them. And it doesn't matter what the team in front is doing, and I think that's exactly right. Maybe this is a team that needs to rely on goaltending a little bit more this year.
But they had two shutouts in the Rangers series last year. I mean, he played well. That was still not enough. Just, you know, chalking up the Lundqvist, I guess, was a little bit better. Well, we'll take a break here on the Sports Reporters. Coming up, we'll talk a little more about some of the ancillary part of the game, work in the Chris Borland retirement with the NHL and some of the problems that football and the NHL may both be having going forward, or maybe not. We'll ask the question, do you think this is a watershed moment for sports when guys are, after a year in leagues, deciding on their own accord just to shut it down? Or was this just going to be a story that passes quickly? Mike Colligan in for the Sports Reporters here on Trib Live Radio.
Giovanni's Pizza and Pasta, located on 6th Street in downtown Pittsburgh. Fast and free delivery. Give them a call at 412-281-7060. Lunch specials starting at just $7.49 with selections including small grilled chicken salad, a bowl of soup, two cuts of pizza and a small garden salad, penne pasta, garlic bread and a small salad, half a hoagie and french fries or half a hoagie and a can of pop. That's 412-281-7060. You can even order online. Giovanni's Pizza and Pasta in downtown Pittsburgh and online at ilovegiovannis.com.
Trib Live Radio presents the Sports Reporters.
By virtue of being on this battlefield, there is no return. People will die. Some will be disfigured.
Always professional.
And as usual, no touching of the hair and face.
Fighting it out on all the biggest topics of the week.
There's not going to be any fight without Scott Riles and the incredibly polite Canadian news team.
Give me a break. They can't have news. Nothing happens in Canada.
We're going to gouge your eyes out and kick your head in. Sorry.
I like your ginger ale.
It's time to start the brawl.
Who are you wearing today? Oh, look, it's your own blood.
The Sports Reporters on Trib Live Radio.
First day of spring. Looks like it outside the Trib Total Media Studios. Snow's swirling. It's hockey weather. That's why we got Mike Colligan in. But spring football is happening. College hoops we'll get to a little bit later in the show. Biggest story of the week in pro football may have been, depending on how you view this one, guys, the Chris Borland retirement, the rookie linebacker from the San Francisco 49ers who called it quits. Fear of head trauma. Didn't really, Josh, even say he had any recent concussions, right? More of just afraid of where it would go. Oh, he did say he got dinged in preseason. That was one of the...
He did say he had some concerns in the preseason. I guess he took a shot to the head and he kind of stuck with him and...
That's preseason of his rookie year, which means he's questioning it from the minute he played in the NFL.
Which is hard to that's a hard thing to try to swallow when you're going in, especially something that you dreamed about since you were a kid and you're walking into it already with concerns. But that's the reality now. And actually, I think it's great. I think some people are thinking that it's more of a knee jerk response, more of a panic type situation. I think it's better to know going forward. I think it's better when you know the risks. And I will continue to hammer this home. The NFL and the NHL and the teams and leagues that have, you know, high contact in their sport, they need to just be up front. This is what you're looking at. This is what you can face. These are the dangers. This is what can happen to you. There's a lot of dangerous jobs in this world, and those guys get up every morning and kiss their wives goodbye, knowing there's a chance they may not come home because their jobs are dangerous, but they know it going in. And the NFL and the NHL, they know this as well as the players do. This isn't like it's new information. They know there's dangers with this. They know there's risks with this. The NHL, we've seen what happened with Eric Lindros. We know what we're looking at here. Be honest about it. Don't have a player retire one day and say he has worries about head trauma, and then a neurosurgeon that's hired by an NFL team come back the next day and say, oh, the game's safer than it's ever been. We're not believing it. And here's the thing. Even if it is true, you still look standoffish and you still look antagonistic. Be open about it. Say, look, yeah, we do have a dangerous sport, but here's what we're trying to do to keep it safe. Here's the steps that we're trying to make. Here's what we're telling our players, and we're making a more conscious effort to be more, you know, open about it and err on the side of caution. If they do that, it's different.
The two sports, I think, are a little bit different. I mean, you could play hockey for 20 years and never get a concussion.
True.
I mean, the thing about football, depending on your position, though, you're almost every game your head's getting banged around somewhere. A lot, you know, linemen dozens of times a game. Mike Webster never had a diagnosed concussion, and, you know, but thousands of blows to the head over the years, maybe not one single one enough to cause a concussion, or, you know, a guy like Muhammad Ali even. I think you could play, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, that there aren't dangers in hockey, but I think you could play hockey without, I don't think it's as, they're estimating now 28% of NFL players have some kind of CTE after they retire.
Is hockey safer, Mike? I feel like the game, the NHL game, you'd be hard-pressed to go any game without getting jostled at least some, or have a violent stop, or, you know, I don't know about head trauma. I mean, it's a fine line there, I guess, but it's pretty violent too out there.
I
mean,
I actually suffered a number of concussions in hockey, and I think not all were just cheap shots. It's a game that is very high speed. It's a game that is played within concrete walls effectively with the boards there, and there's times when you get hit from the wrong angle and go in, and that's the problem. And I think the point about the preseason concussion for Borland was interesting, where the pressure of a guy that's coming in as a rookie, you're trying to make the team in the first place, and yep, you take this hit that potentially could put you out for who knows how long, weeks, months, maybe the year. There's a pressure there for a young guy that needs to make the team that is very tough to get over. Common sense kind of goes out the window, and I wonder if that was part of the factor there. I think that applies in hockey too, where a guy like, I know Craig Adams has said it in the past, where he's played through knee injuries and significant problems that I think would keep other guys out of the lineup. But when you're a fringe player and you think, the second that I let that spot up and let a younger guy come in, I may never get back into it. And I think that's the biggest mental hurdle that's never going to disappear from sports.
What about what Pascal Dupuis said in the story that he wrote for the Players Tribune? He says, you know, in hockey, it's a culture where you're expected to play through injuries. You're expected, you know, to be tough. You're expected to ignore whatever's ailing you and say, you know what, I have to be back out there. I have to go play. I have to be tough. And, you know, something like what happened with him with an aneurysm and a blood clot really changes everything. And he said, you know, he had to, it took him a while to really accept that, hey, this is something that can kill me. And he had to really, you know, step back and finally pull himself out. But it's a culture where it's expected for you to actually, you know, they say toughen up and, you know, knuckle up and go out and do what you got to do regardless of what's ailing you. And sometimes that could be dangerous. But
there was a guy last year that basically had a heart attack and wanted to go back in and play.
Yeah.
Who was that? You remember?
Rich Peverly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is a culture with that there, and Mike's right about the speed. I mean, you know, the fastest human being around can maybe run 22, 23 miles an hour. Those guys are skating 35. Two guys skating full speed in the NHL that hit head on, it's a 70 mile an hour collision. But I think you can, I don't think it's avoidable in football. I think if you play football, you're going to bang your head. I guess it's not avoidable in hockey either, but I think it's, I don't think it's a guarantee.
The way the rules are called right now, I don't think it is avoidable, and I don't know how football ever would change the rules in a way that would take that element out of the game.
Yeah, it would ruin it.
You'd change the whole sport. Well, Lindros is an interesting example. He was ridiculed by a lot of people, and certainly a lot of fans, for being not tough enough and not, you know, sucking it up.
Well, people here were ridiculing Sidney Crosby for last Saturday, and I told you guys what I know that I can't reveal. There's a very good reason he didn't play in that game. I mean, people would be, oh, come on for the warm-up. How could he not play?
Well, dating back to the concussion issue, he had a lot of critics both inside Pittsburgh and outside of Pittsburgh. Why does he go play? He's a hockey player. He should be playing. He's being a punk. No.
Hines Ward with Ben.
Yeah, like, no. His brain got scrambled around in his skull. He's trying to make sure it still works.
Well, the one thing that I do like, and I see more and more guys, it seems like almost every guy in the Penguins wears a mouth guard anymore. People, that's not to protect your teeth. I mean, it might, but it's to keep your jaw from snapping, and I think people have wised up to that. You even see some baseball players wearing them now. My dentist has said for years that, yeah, And in any sport, if your jaw snaps hard enough, you can get a concussion from a jaw snap.
Mm-hmm. Well, just that, you know, the informed nature of athletes now. What you're talking about, the medical awareness of it. Chris Borland obviously did his homework. He's making an informed decision to step away where maybe Lindros didn't have that information. Will we now, Mike, see athletes in droves retiring sooner? Or is this just, this is just one isolated example. People know the risks. They still crave the lifestyle and the life and want to be in the spotlight, and they're going to just take the risk.
Well, I think Jake Locker retired recently as well, and he was the guy that came out and said he made – $15 million, and I think for a lot of us, $15 million would take care of you for a pretty long time. And when you look at weighing those options and weighing, when you've got families involved and what some of these guys think are, we think was their childhood dream, it may not have been. It may just be the path that they were on, or they had parents that pushed them down that path, or they were so far in by the time you get to a high level that what are you going to do, quit and go into accounting for the rest of your life? This is your path, and once you get to that point where now all of a sudden your health is at risk, and I think these guys start to weigh, hey, I've got the money. Do I really need to keep putting myself at risk? That's a tough question.
That was Barry Sanders. Barry Sanders admitted at some point when he played for the Lions, he actually did not like football for a while growing up, but his father made him play football. And it just so happens he was good at it, and he was able to go to college at Oklahoma State to do it. And he went to the Detroit Lions. He became one of the best running backs ever played the game. But he stopped at a young age. He said, you know what, I've done pretty much almost everything there is to do. He never won a Super Bowl. It's one of his biggest regrets. But, you know, he said at one point, you know, I still want to be able to enjoy playing with my kids. I want to be able to enjoy going into my older years, knowing that I did everything I could playing football, but still be able to enjoy, you know, a good lifestyle, a good quality of life in my older years, and walk away with it with a clear conscience. That's exactly what he did. And there aren't many people that think that way, that play the game. And I don't know if you noticed that Maurice Clarett had a lot of comments on Twitter about it, too. He said, for some people, it depends on where you come from. Some people, it's a culture where you get as much as you can for as long as you can. For some people, it's more or less where you know you have a plan going in. You know you might have plans for after football. But for some people, it's just the culture they come up in, and it's how they're raised. And, Mike, you put it perfectly. Sometimes people are pushing that direction because it's all they have. How many players do we see coming out of college going into the NFL? They may leave a year early because they're like, look, I got a whole family here to support because my whole family's living in substandard conditions or substandard quality of life. So they feel that extra pressure to not only have a career for themselves but try to provide for everybody around them because they're being pushed in that direction.
So yes or no, do you see retirements in droves? Or acceptance of.
I think we'll see more of them. I think we'll see more players stepping away early. I don't think it'll be such a big number where people are saying, "Oh, it's going to be a big trend." I don't think it'll be a huge trend where we'll have 10 players a year retiring at 28, 29.
10 a year? That's pretty significant.
I don't see that happening.
Oh, but
I don't see that. But I do think we'll see more Chris Borlands every once in a while where a kid will pop up and say, "You know what? It's bigger than this. I can do something else." I think we'll see more conscientious people. I think we'll see more players actually maybe deciding to sit out a game or two. Maybe we'll hear more about concussions being reported, which is actually a good thing.
Well, you go back. Lynn Swann quit basically because of concussions and played 8 years. And at the time,
because of George Atkinson,
that stood out. We've had four guys in a month in the NFL now. Droves, I don't think so, but four guys in a month is certainly a trend.
Yeah, well, not all concussions, you know, but
no, but injuries.
Certainly injury, yeah.
I think it's
three injuries and a religious.
It's a trend that'll continue, and I think it'll be dictated by the research and what comes out. You know, we don't know what a year from now that we'll know about concussions, and if it does keep going in the direction it seems to be going, it may become a tougher and tougher question. You know, Borland mentioned, hey, I couldn't find a decision or true evidence one way or the other, but just that concern was enough for him. If we start to see more on kind of that, other side of the scale where guys really start to see this is proof that there are issues from repetitive head trauma, not just these huge concussions that put guys out for a month, that could really turn the tides for a sport like football.
Well, you write about the business of sports quite a bit with Forbes and your connections with the financial part of the hockey game, Mike. Where does this go for football and hockey in terms of the cost? As Josh said, you have quickly Joseph Maroon's coming out with his spin. They don't want to accept any guilt here or admit any potential flaws to their game. A lot at stake
when you have billion-dollar lawsuits hanging over a game. I think that's what happens is they're going to be very careful with what they do admit to or put out there, and it may not be what they want to say or all the things that they know, but they know that what that could ultimately mean for a lawsuit is going to dictate that. Yeah. But I think when I look at hockey, you know, there's been a lot of talk about, do we change the size of the ice? Do we make it wider? I know Ray Shiro was a proponent of that, and that's going to be difficult to do with the arenas that they've built now custom for this size ice. It's going to be tough to pull out 2-3 rows of seats there that are premium seats. I think that's going to be tough to do, but really it's a game that's physical. It's a game that's fast. And again, I think that might be dictating why we're seeing less penalties and more obstruction in hockey right now.
Because so many people watch football, Guy, there's just such – the demand's not going to go away. I don't think the sport's ever going to be in really that much trouble. They're going to find people to play because the money's so good and because people just want to watch it. It's such a part of the fabric now.
Well, I mean, the game has changed a ton since I started watching it. And there are guys my age, it's like, you know, it's flag football now, but there's still more people watching it than ever, playing fantasy football than ever. And I think – generations will grow up seeing 35-31 games in the passing game that it is now, and a little, it's not the 4 yards in the cloud of dust game that it was 30 years ago, and they'll like it for that. You're in that transition stage now where you have people that have seen it both ways, and you know, older people have a tendency to always complain that it's not the way, as good as it was before. With all our complaints about hockey, I still think hockey's better than it's ever been. I mean, it's got its issues, especially with officiating. Like I was telling these guys the other day, Mike, I started filling in for Myron Cope in my early 20s, and we talked about the same NHL officiating issues in 1984 as we're talking about now. But the actual skill of the – so I go back sometimes and watch, you know, video of guys in the late 70s, early 80s, and they don't look any good. They're not moving nearly as fast. They skate upright. I don't know. I think the players are way better than they ever were before. So I think the sports will survive with adjustments, and I think people will grow up watching them a certain way and enjoy them for what they are. But when you're in a – we're in a major – especially with football, I think we've really been in a transition period the last 20 years.
Sports reporters here on Trib Live Radio. Mike Colligan from Colligan Hockey in studio with us, Ken Guy and Josh Taylor. A couple of things to clean up before we end the show. Speaking of money, big event in town, NCAA tournament is here. Second time in, 3 years? 2012 they were here, 2012, 2015. Less than capacity over there yesterday, Guy. You and I were watching the early games.
Well, I took a picture and tweeted out. I said, a lot of empty seats here, and people started attacking me because, it's still the work day. The seats are sold. You know, the Lafayette fans aren't there yet, one guy wrote. And I'm like,
Lafayette fans.
I'm not making a judge, just saying, hey, there's a lot of empty seats here. I thought it would be fuller.
It's an observation.
Yeah, I mean,
I thought it would too.
Back off.
They announced 15,000 for the early session, which is about 4,000 empty seats. Probably were more in the upper bowls, but.
Well, I looked to buy some tickets just about a week ago for a friend of mine, and I couldn't find any that weren't from four rows to the roof. There wasn't anything below. Now, a lot of those seats were empty, but I imagine they were sold. And you're never going to get. I mean, I was telling Mike, I go to the Frozen Four every year. Those games aren't. All the seats are sold, and I mean, if you go to follow one team, you're maybe not going to watch all the games the first day, you know?
Well, I think Pittsburgh handles the events, pulls it off well, Josh. I don't know about you. I think it was well orchestrated over there. But the event itself is tough, even for these fans. Like Notre Dame fans didn't really turn out, I didn't think, in that huge numbers yesterday, but probably tough for the average Notre Dame fan to make this trip. Maybe they want to save for the Sweet 16 or, you know, to expect people to come to every game along the stop. The NCAA gets its money, but in terms of the atmosphere, it's not always easy to pull that off.
That's where all those rich alumni come in. That's why it's good to have those guys on your side,
yeah,
because they're probably the ones making those trips because they're the ones that can afford it. But in terms of the average fan, I think you're right. I mean, you know, especially when it – then again, it depends on where you're going. I mean, if you're making that trip to Pittsburgh for the first round, I mean, with a six-hour drive to South Bend, maybe it's not that big of a deal. But if you look at it from the Notre Dame fans' perspective, in the Final Four in Indianapolis this year?
If they make it to there,
maybe you don't have to worry about traveling because it's right in Indianapolis. Yeah. So this might be the time to make that trip. So for Notre Dame fans,
playing another,
specifically, might
another,
be
another playing a Butler tomorrow. I mean, I would think that would, and it's a Saturday. Now that, I think, is sold out. I couldn't find any tickets for tomorrow. But I was saying to Ken yesterday, we were sitting there watching the Notre Dame game. I went to Penn State, so there was never an issue about buying tickets for the NCAA tournament. But I've been to bowl games both as a fan and covering them for Pitt, Penn State, and West Virginia, that's a one-time thing. All right, and you know it. Say Thanksgiving or around there, what bowl you're going to, you got a month to plan it. If you're the fan of a blue blood, North Carolina, Louisville, Kentucky, Kansas, one of the schools that are always good, how do you plan on what you want to go see? Very few people, even the very wealthy, they're pretty busy, can go three straight weekends to three different places. Which one do you pick? Do you think, this team's good enough? I'll go to the Final Four. I mean, you're not going to drive to all three cities and take off three straight weekends, are you? I don't know.
Might depend on what your family's doing. If you got kids, it might depend on what your kids are doing that weekend. If you don't have any plans, you might only be stuck with this weekend because it's the one weekend your family doesn't have anything going on. I mean, I grew up in a family of four and a lot of times five having the fifth kid around. So my parents had to plan a lot around what we were doing. So if you have a family with a few kids, that might be your only weekend to go, maybe if you're going to see the Elite Eight and the Sweet 16. That might be your best shot.
Ken, I would bet 80% of the people over yesterday were just Pittsburgh people that went to watch it. Wouldn't you say so?
Well, like, you know, Northeastern had a big section there. I was talking to a bunch of the alumni, and it was $100 for the seat to be in the section. But you had to find your own way to Pittsburgh. That's not easy on a short notice. I mean, easily those people were dropping $1,000.
Yeah, I mean, they just selected them Sunday night. I mean, yeah.
Yep.
And so, you could see how they obviously balance these situations and these places geographically, who are the draws. And I think it is tough when you find out Sunday night where your team's going to be playing, and especially when you do have multiple options, when you look at a number one or number three seed that should have a big following, and they say, do I really want to go and spend this kind of money to go to a first-round game that if you're a number one or three seed, that should be a blowout in most cases? That's these aren't cheap tickets anymore in college sports.
Well, it's interesting to me is to hear Robert Morris playing in that they win the first-round play-in game, to see that USA Today reported that's worth $1.5 million to the conference, $1.5 million to the Northeast Conference.
For a play-in game.
For every win. Yeah, now they'll get another unit because they advanced to Charlotte. So that's big money.
The conference shares that money, though. Robert Morris doesn't get to keep it, right?
Not all of it. Like, different conferences have different ways. I think Northeastern gets a bigger share in the Colonial Conference than for making it as the team that gets in. Everybody
sure else. You would have went to the greedy school.
Well,
I'm not a big fan of the playing games, but when you bring up a point like that, is it not inevitable that at some point we're beyond 68 teams here and we have probably half of – maybe teams get a bye now, but if there's that much money at stake, there's going to be a cash grab here. The NCAA would be crazy not to expand this, and unfortunately it probably makes for a worse product.
Definitely does. Especially if they start paying players. They're going to have to expand it to – everybody gets in, you know, play 300 tournament.
It'll turn into basketball. You better believe it. They'll have two-man sack races until a champion is crowned. We're getting to that point. You know it's coming.
Yeah, so I do worry about that, it being kind of run into the ground here in the next 10 years as this college sports change, how they pay athletes. Well, let's get landing on a good note here. Buster Olney has picked the Pirates to win the World Series.
Beat Seattle, I saw. Yeah.
It's Buster Olney to be trusted. You guys support this. And what does this do to the Pirates' psyche? I mean, to be the favorite? This is unheard of.
Does Fedco know? That's the important question. Does Fedco know?
I don't think he comes out from his
home. Well, he's not going to pick the Dodgers or the Nationals. Or, I mean, you know, those guys want to make a little bit of a splash. A little bit.
See,
I mean,
Colligan Hockey should have that. Mike Colligan picks Pirates to win World Series. You want to get some page views? Come on.
Ottawa Senators for the Stanley Cup.
There you go.
The Pirates are, it's amazing how that really, the motto of that franchise has shifted in the last few years. It suddenly is the hot ticket that we probably thought was impossible with what we saw over two decades there. And now I feel like the thinking has shifted outside of Pittsburgh as well, where now this is no longer the laughingstock franchise. And I think it's a great point. What does that do when you're suddenly not these scrappy underdogs that with no expectations? Now you've got what people are saying is the best outfield in baseball. Now you've got the pressure of teams starting to pick you. How does a group like that without a lot of playoff success and experience handle that?
What do you think, guy? You were down there for 2 weeks.
It was weird to me. First of all, 9,000 people for a Pirates-Tigers Grapefruit League game the other day. And the thing that really struck me, first of all, there was a ton of Korean media because of Kong there. But there's Carl Ravitch and John Kruk and a whole ESPN set on the infield at McKechnie Field interviewing Pirate after Pirate going live. And, you know, the national media that are there covering them is what's like –
Sunday Night Baseball's here this year, right?
Yeah.
First time.
Yep.
So that's
great.
It is great, but will this affect the team on the field, Josh? Can they handle the pressure?
I don't think so, because, Guy, you could probably attest to this. It sounds like they're talking about that they realize that this team has a chance to win a World Series. So I don't think it'll affect them as far as a mental standpoint. It sounds like they're ready for the challenge, at least. At least they're saying the right thing.
It's a much more business-like approach. Yeah. I think they know what's expected of them. There wasn't as much screwing around at spring training. And to some extent, that's what spring training's for. I mean, baseball, you're out in the sun in Florida. Every minute shouldn't be. But I'm talking about guys like Tony Sanchez and Andrew Lambeau, who have kind of these boisterous personalities. They were serious as a heart attack down there this year. And the whole team, and there's very few jobs available. Everybody's getting prepared. Everybody knows. You know, I think, all right, they won the wild card game and made a nice run against the Cardinals 2 years ago. And I think a lot of people, especially across the country, thought, oh, what a nice little story. The Pirates are significant again for another year. Doing it again last year now and looking at what they have in the minor leagues, Baseball America, you know, liking a lot of the up-and-coming players that they have as well, people take them seriously.
What's interesting about the Pirates, I think, is this is still a high-risk, high-return roster. This is the way they've had to build this team. This isn't a sure thing. We've seen 2 years in a row where they've gotten the high return. What happens if A.J. Burnett does not come back and perform like he did, or Liriano? Do they have the depth in the pitching staff? I think there's a lot of questions
there. Or Josh Harrison was a flash in the pan for 1 year, or, you know.
Well, right. They start to feel the pressure, too. The Shiro, Rutherford, let's go for it, trade first-round picks at deadlines. Neil Huntington seems a oblivious to that. Like he's always trying to spin it to the future.
If he didn't do it, Ken, when his job was pretty much on the line, I don't see him doing it now.
But with World Series expectations, patient. I think that could change it. You know,
and how long's the window? You know, you look at Tampa Bay, they had a similar rise in a division where they were kind of the national darling going up against the powerhouses of the Red Sox and Yankees, but they can't sustain that for so long. When you have a small market team that's building high-risk, high-return rosters, at some point it turns back, and you just got to figure out how do you reload without taking that shot and going all in.
Yeah, you see Neil Walker and Pedro with down to 2 years. I'm not saying he's going to turn into – you know, Moneyball, Oakland A's last year going after Lester and mortgaging the future. I don't think Huntington would ever, but I wonder if he would start to, you know,
Key is this outfield. I mean, they're young, they're under control for a while, and I think you can continue to build around them. If you do get to a panic year, you're thinking the window's closing when McCutcheon's 30, you know.
By the way, I can't let Culligan get out of here without mentioning this. You see this headline? What if Connor McDavid ends up with the Philadelphia Flyers?
Oh,
so I guess we're not ending it on a good note. You had to pretend the apocalypse here. Could that actually happen?
The NHL has moved this year to spreading out the draft odds a little bit more than they have amongst the non-playoff teams, and I couldn't believe that the Flyers had 6% chance of winning the draft lottery. So that is mind-boggling, and I think I'm all for parity in sports, and I think the salary cap's been great. It's spread the talent across. But when you look at, you probably should have the worst teams getting the best players, especially when they're franchise-changing players.